Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This show, I pay tribute to the late University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor Rudy Krejci. Throughout his life, he consistently questioned authority.
I always reminded my professors that it has been 5, 10, 20, 30 years since Project Chariot resulted in firing of Dr. Pruitt, Wehrig, and others. When are they going to stand up and ask university to review the whole case?
We hear from Rudy himself about his life under Nazi and communist regimes. We also hear from his son, Dr. Paul Krejci, who shares lessons he gleaned from Rudy.
Always be skeptical, have a healthy degree of skepticism, and always try to figure out where is this information coming from.
I hope you'll join me for this special edition of Northern Soundings. On Sunday afternoon, family, colleagues, former students, and friends of Rudy Krejci plan to salute his life and legacy. Rudy passed away in December last year, and his life was remarkable for many reasons. He was born in Czechoslovakia, his country was invaded by Nazi Germany, and he had to go into hiding after protesting communism following World War II. After a daring escape to Austria, he earned his doctorate in philosophy and eventually found himself in 1960 in the office of then UA president Ernest Patti. Patti laughed at Rudy's notion of teaching philosophy at the school and instead offered him a job teaching Russian and German. But Rudy persevered, eventually establishing philosophy as a UAF discipline and, along with his colleague Walt Benisch, establishing the local Socratic Society. Perhaps it was his training in philosophy or his maturity under totalitarianism, but Rudy was a lifelong contrarian. As you'll hear, he fought the money and prestige offered to UA when Edward Teller proposed excavating a harbor at Cape Thompson, Alaska, by detonating hydrogen bombs. Many fellow protesters lost their jobs at UA over the incident, but Rudy survived. Over the years, he worked to see the reputations of dismissed academics rehabilitated. I knew Rudy for many years and had the privilege of interviewing him for summer sessions in 2017 when his health was faltering. Some of the audio for today's show is taken from that discussion. I'm also friends with Rudy's son, Dr. Paul Krejci, who's a gifted musician and teacher at UAF. I invited Paul to reflect on his father, both as a parent and as a mentor. Music woven throughout the show today is performed by Paul. Back in 2017, I asked Rudy to reflect on his early life.
I was born into a new state which regained its existence after 300 years. In 1918, Czechoslovakia was reintroduced among nations of Western Europe. In Czechoslovakia, there were following nationalities: Czech, German, Russian, in part Russian, in part Polish, but the great majority were Czechs. My father was a Czech, but he attended only German schools. So he had problem to write Czech, but he spoke Czech perfect. So from my father, I got German. He taught me German, and the second language he taught me was Russian, which he learned during the First World War when he was part of the Austrian army in Russia. And he always told me, you have to be ready for your enemies. The best thing is to know the language they speak. So learn as good as possible German, because we will be one day occupied by Germany. And this was a good advice. Then second language, during the Second World War, he taught me Russian. Of course, in secret. Had somebody learned he's teaching his son Russian, he would have been arrested. From this point of view, I was well prepared for the end of the Second World War. My German was good, my Russian was also quite good, so I was able to get involved in the mainstreams of politics. I was Democrat, and I had my sympathy with Czech National Socialist Party. I was a socialist, Czech socialist, because I saw that this is the only future of humanity. So I was advocating Czech type of socialism. And this brought me into fight with communism, which organized themselves with help of Russians in Czechoslovakia. I organized a group, an anti-communist group, and we were distributing leaflets in 49. I was finishing gymnasium. In the meantime, we were distributing leaflets all over the Central when we were observed by a secret policeman. They started chasing after us, and this was last time I saw my friends, with exception of one. Next day, I was lucky to meet one of my friends who was coming to our house, and he told me, "Have you seen the other friends?" Bob, one of us, was captured by police. So we gave him about a few hours before they get the names out of him. And this is exactly what happened. By beating him, you know, he disclosed all other names. I have decided to go to see another friend who was not involved and stayed in his house. Police had an exact description on my clothes. I anticipated that. So I decided to send one of my friends to our house, asking my parents to give him clothes and some money. My friend went. He said, "Mr. Krejci, I have a message from your son." I said, come in, young man." So he gave him clothes, money, and everything. And before he left, he told me, "If you mention to anybody what transpired here, I will come and shoot you." My friend, when we met two, three hours later, was still shaking. And this was last time I saw him. He's a judge in Czechoslovakia. He still doesn't want to see me. I stayed with my friend, and my father came in. He was told where we were, and he came and told me, "So, boys, what do you want to do now? You cannot finish your matura. You cannot finish your examination in gymnasium." I asked my father what he would suggest. "We cannot trust anybody in our society. I will bring you home." At night, he brought me home, and I was hiding in a cellar, in the coal, in the cellar. And secret police made an agreement with my parents that when they hear something about me, they will be told by secret police. Of course, nothing ever came in. It started with 1 week, lasted altogether 5 years. So after 5 years, my father came with a brilliant idea. "I will load you into a railway train which carries coal from Moravia to Italy. We have to do the whole work at night, and the work will consist of inserting a coffin into the coal. After you dig up a hole in the coal, you put a coffin into it, cover the coffin with coal, and leave an opening through which you get into the coffin when you are on the train." Because he was a railwayman, my father was able to figure out what is happening on the border. On the border, there were secret policemen walking along all trains with dogs. And these dogs were underneath of the train, jumped from wagon to wagon and aside from the train. I was in the coffin all of a sudden I hear one of them landed just above me, above my coffin. He made a sound. I was covered with a mixture of vinegar, pepper, paprika, salt, and this is what the dog reacted to. So he jumped off, and a few minutes later, the train started moving. I arrived in first Austrian village, and it rained very heavily, so I decided I will take a risk and get out. So I got out, and not noticing that I was being observed by an Austrian railway man. This railway man came to me and told me, you need some help. I sure do. At first you have to wash your face. You are completely black. So I did. Then he bought me a ticket to Vienna. So I went into an apartment in the train. Nobody was there. All of a sudden, the door opens. Two Soviet soldiers entered the compartment. I was afraid that they will hear my heart beating. And so I covered myself with a coat. Since I understood Russian, I understood that they were all excited to go to Vienna for entertainment. They did not care about me at all. In Vienna, they got off the train. So I walked into the center of Vienna. My father told me, don't ever try to communicate with a middle-aged Austrian. You are always, can be sure, to communicate with old ladies. So I did. I met an old lady and asked her in German, where is American zone? And she showed me. Two blocks ahead of you and one block to the right, and you will be in American zone. This is how I got into American embassy, and this was the beginning of my new life.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm sharing parts of a discussion I had with the late Rudy Krejci, who taught at UAF. There's a celebration of his life planned for Sunday afternoon. When we return, Rudy's son Paul takes up the story. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This show is examining the life and legacy of former UAF philosophy professor Rudy Krejci. He died this past December, and a celebration of his life and legacy is planned this coming Sunday afternoon. Back in 2017, I had the privilege of interviewing Rudy, and more recently I spoke with his son, Paul. Let's hear from Paul about the 5 years of hiding Rudy endured under communism.
When my father went underground, he had to stay in the apartment. His father gave him an education in the sense of finding books for him to read and just to pass the time. And so his father would often go to the library and find particular books, and particular books that also were banned. These are books by T.J. Masaryk, the first president of Czechoslovakia. He was a philosopher. So think of it kind of like as a philosopher king, you know, idea. And his works weren't meant to be read, you know, by the populace. And so his father was able to secure those books. So think about it. And for 5 years, my father was given an education basically by books that his father was able to grab then from the library. You know. And my father, he went to a gymnasium, but it was the different types of gymnasium. You know, there's a type where you have kind of a more liberal arts sort of education. And then there's the other one that's more of a trade school. And he went to the trade school. And that's where he kind of developed this idea of being able to work with his hands and While at the same time, you know, I think also getting some level of a liberal arts education as well. But I think it was especially during those years when he was underground that what can he do? He just read and read and read, and he developed an extensive, you know, knowledge, very deep knowledge of various disciplines in history, philosophy, sciences, mathematics. There was also a bit of music there. Of course, you know, if you're going to be underground, you're not going to want to make too much of it. <Yeah. laughs> But what he did, he had a piano there and he stuffed pillows into it. And so he wouldn't make a sound, but he would practice, play through sweet pieces. And so imagine he's thinking about the music in his head, which is a great ability to have, you know, and to think of music in a different way, not music that actually is audible, you know, but it's something you have to imagine in your head. So I guess it kind of goes to this idea of the quadrivium and the trivium and the idea.
Which are these ancient ideas about mm-hmm. what are core disciplines for mm-hmm. education.
Yeah. So we have quadrivium. Of course, we have music, right? Which is one of them, which is you wouldn't think, okay,
yeah.
maybe one of these lesser sort of disciplines, but no, it was one of the quadrivium, and of course astronomy and geometry
right, and arithmetic.
And those are things that he cultivated. And then with the trivium, of course, rhetoric, logic, and grammar. So those, the linguistic, you know, sort of disciplines. And on the other side of the quadrivium, you had the scientific, the measuring, you know, sort of systems. But I think he was fortunate. He had parents, very supportive parents. His father, like I said, provided him with an education and really protected him from authorities. And his mother very lovingly took care of him with meals. And I can imagine that's not yet. I can't really imagine so much, but being in the same household for 5 years, not being able to leave and trying to not go insane. You know, that, and
we hear about Anne Frank's diary, and mm-hmm. that's really a very short period of time compared to mm-hmm. the length your dad had to hide out in a secret room.
That's right, yeah. I mean, for 5 years, and he kept on, and of course, he didn't think it was going to be 5 years. He thought maybe it'd just be a few weeks, a few months, maybe a year, and then next year goes by, and then, you know, if you survive this long, okay, you can make it a little bit longer. And then I think what was a real turning point was 1953. Stalin, you know, had died, and he thought was things are going to really improve, and they didn't. And so it was decided then in 54 he had to get out.
Both your grandfather and your father seem to have been realists in mm-hmm. terms of politics. And it was your grandfather really urged your father to learn these languages mm-hmm. so that he could make his way in the world. That's pretty astute.
It is, yeah. Now, it's my understanding that his father actually wanted to immigrate during the 20s. I think he had the idea of wanting to go, you know, to the United States. And the idea of pragmatism, I think, was something that he embraced as an idea. And an idea, too, as at least as an idea that was being sold to the rest of the world, the idea of American democracy, was something that had caught his eye, I think, quite early as a young man himself from my grandfather. And, yeah, so those ideas, you know, were instilled in my father. And with the circumstances, he had to eventually escape alone then and reach the West. And when it talks about his escape then by train, reaching Vienna, then eventually making to Innsbruck, where he studied and worked on a PhD, but then traveled to the United States a couple times. You know, he actually, during the time he was working on his PhD, he went to the United States. That was in 57, and he stayed there for about a half a year. He made actually quite a bit of money. I think he told me they made like $7,000.
In those days, that was quite a bit.
And he worked many different jobs. Talks about being
a waiter
at a Czech restaurant in San Francisco. The owner of the restaurant sponsored him. He was a Czech himself. And that's where he had the opportunities to meet many different people. Hollywood stars from L.A. came up. One of them, Jan Vine. I don't know if you heard of Jan Vine, but that's the way my dad understood him, because that's how his name is called in Europe. And that's John Wayne, you know? So when people asked me, he didn't know who John Wayne was. He thought he was quite an idiot, you know? And that, he knew him as Jan Vine. You know?
I think I prefer the European pronunciation.
I like it. And people like that, Jack Lemmon and Bing Crosby visited the restaurant. I guess it was very well known in the 50s. Had that sort of, he had that job. He worked as a security guard during the night time. Then you worked also Bechtel Steel, you know, and you, where you worked as an engineer and then also as someone who was educating some of his fellow American engineers about Russian science. This is the time, of course, 57, Sputnik, and how a good number of Americans didn't believe it. They didn't think it was something that Russians themselves could have developed. They thought it was something of a, it was a German technology that may have been used by the Russians, or they thought it was just fake. And my father taught his American peers about the history of Russian science.
Something about your dad's personality. He was very comfortable approaching people and engaging with people. Mm-hmm. Did I have that right?
No, you got, yeah. He was gregarious and had no fear. And he was genuinely interested, I think, in just other people. Particularly people who were interesting just to begin with, you know, by name. And yeah, I think because his, many of these were people who were from the old country, from Europe. And so there was a sort of that language he could always connect with, and he could speak German and speak Russian. And that would allow then people who were Europe, perhaps where English was not something that they were comfortable speaking in. It was, he was able to, you know, develop a dialogue speaking in the older languages. So yeah, no, I think just, he was, like I said, a very sociable person. And like I said, yeah, never afraid. He would just speak his mind or ask questions, even questions that were uncomfortable.
And challenge.
You challenge these great thinkers, you know, and that. And I think sometimes they would be taken back, you know, by that. But it would spur on a dialogue.
Well, I want to go back to this idea of education again, because in a curious way, he seems to marry both of those things, that mm-hmm. European tradition of ideas informing, even if you're a waiter or even if you're an engineer, those mm-hmm. ideas carry you in a fundamental way, and it's part of your birthright to kind of explore those, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he talks about a worldview, right? A Weltanschauung, you know, in German. And, you know, in the video that was done by Dan O'Neill, there's a talk about a worldview. And I think in some way that's something that's very much cultivated, particularly in continental Europe, the idea of you develop a worldview. It's a sign of being an educated person. And it doesn't really matter what sort of discipline that you are in. You could be doing white-collar work, blue-collar work, and that. But you have a worldview, and you have this baseline of an education where you can have this sort of worldview and be able to interconnect your experience, perhaps as someone who's just using your hands, but you're able to, you know about Dostoevsky, for example, and at the same time it's reverse of that as well, you know. And you, this idea of someone who's an elitist in terms of intellectually, though, should also be able to use his or her hands as well.
Wasn't it in The Endless Quest by Karl Popper, mm-hmm. where he talks about apprenticing at a cabinet maker?
A cabinet maker, yeah, right. That was a book that my dad introduced me to, you know, when I was a teenager, and that was something that was very influential. But Popper is also using the same type of ideas, I think, as well. Popper was his philosophical father figure and reinforced a lot of the ideas that he had, perhaps independently made himself, about how to approach life and, again, develop a worldview.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Paul Krejci about his dad, Rudy Krejci, who taught at the University of Alaska Fairbanks for decades. But originally, he wasn't hired as a philosophy professor. We'll hear that story when we return.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Northern Soundings. Let's continue this celebration of the life and legacy of Dr. Rudy Krejci, who passed away last December. With his gregarious nature and boundless energy, Rudy made an indelible mark on UAF, certainly by teaching languages through strumming a guitar and singing, but perhaps most significantly in his opposition to Project Chariot. It was a program to detonate nuclear bombs to create a harbor at Cape Thompson. Several UAF scientists lost their jobs opposing the project, and Rudy spent decades trying to rehabilitate their reputations. When I talked with Rudy in 2017, I asked him about his initial interview with then-UA President Ernest Patty.
Patty was the resident. So, what do you want to do here? Well, I want to teach philosophy. He started laughing. Well, why do you laugh? We never had it. We are not going to have it. Forget that nonsense. This is what president of university is telling me. So, can you do something what makes sense? He asked. So I told him, I know I can speak few languages. Which languages? I'm German. And he said, secretary, call a German instructor. So it was a German who came, and I was examined, and in German, he said, yeah, it's very good. He's no native speaker of German, but his German is excellent. What else can you do? Russian. A Russian came. The same, yeah. No, his Russian is good, you know. He's not a Russian native speaker, but his Russian is good. Here you have 9 months, $7,100 or 9 months, and teach German and Russian. Take it or leave it. So this is how I ended. So I taught both languages with a guitar, singing Russian and German songs. I had classes with 40 students, 30 were signed up. They were coming, you know, just to hear Russian and German music. It was very popular. 2 years later, I started teaching philosophy. After him came Dr. Wood, and Dr. Wood listened to me, and I was working immediately on program. When I brought program of philosophy, he told me, you know, I don't understand your language here. Could you write it in a poetic form? I never wrote a poetry, but I wrote a program in philosophy, 2 pages in poetic form. He read it and told me, I hope you are better philosopher than poet. You know, I introduce philosophy in such a way, explaining that there is no room for philosophy in America. That our whole society is organized according to emphasis on labor, having profit from the labor, which is, example, University of Alaska was organized as School of Mines and School of Agriculture. So I use the example, this has nothing to do with university. We do not have university. And I taught for the first time course in idea of philosophy. Nobody at the university heard about Greek concept of trivium, quadrivium, which during the Middle Ages became 7 liberal arts. This became the core of Western concept of university, to which other disciplines were coming, like medicine, law, and other. So at the end of Middle Ages, there were 4 faculties. Faculty of philosophy, which comprised everything with the exception of medicine, law, and theology. So these were 4 faculties. Students were able to study in 1 of 4 faculties. This is idea of Western university. This is during Middle Ages when we do not have emphasis on practicality. In 17th, 18th century under Napoleon is responsible for first technological school. But humanities were emphasized. Of course, theology. Everything was under the tent of theology. So this is how I saw things, you know, in America. And with Dr. Wood, I gave him idea of philosophy. and he did not fully understand it. He said, we don't have law, we don't have theology, we will never have it. So what we have, kind of remnants of university offerings from the whole idea of philosophy, but represented with emphasis on practicality. It is the only philosophy, American philosophy, is pragmatism. I have to admit that sometimes I jig a little bit under the skin of the students. I came into class and the students were talking about St. John. They had some argument, and I took over the argument and I told them, I think St. John is totally mistaken with his claim at the beginning was the Word, and God was the Word. And they were shaken. You dare to question St. John? You say that he was wrong? Oh, yes, he was wrong. Now, what was for you at the beginning? No, idea. Idea in the mind of man. Words are words. And I gave them example from five languages. You have five languages which represent one idea. When you learn a language, you understand the other language through the idea you have. Without these ideas, you could not understand. Of course, the students went home and said, we have a new instructor who challenged St. John. What did he say? He challenged that he was wrong. Dr. Wood called me on carpet and told me, you know, this is what I hear in legislature, that I have here a communist criticizing the fathers of the church. So I explained him what I meant. He was interested in my idea that at the beginning is the idea. He was professor of literature, and I kind of answered him his question. And he told me, you have to talk with me about it, that at the beginning was the idea. So we had meetings, and we were good friends. Until 62, Project Chariot. So Project Chariot was a project to explode five atomic bombs above Kotzebue and dig an artificial harbor. Money was coming to Alaska. Most Alaskans were excited. This was to be done under leadership of famous physicist Edward Teller, who became my good friend. And he was coming here and he invited me for lunch when he learned that I am opposed. We parted our way because he could not convince me. My closest friends were Professor Pruitt and Professor Virik. Professor Pruitt was my student in Russian when I was teaching Russian. So he was the leader of the whole group. Professor Virik was another one. So there were about four or five people. So we were in a minority of very few people. Dr. Wood decided to fire Dr. Pruitt and Dr. Virik. Practically all those involved were fired by Dr. Wood. I don't know how I survived, because when I was introducing philosophy, which he approved, I was fighting for Project Chariot. So I was lucky. I survived as the only one. I have to tell you, for 30 years, I was giving lectures all over the campus. I always reminded my professors that it has been 5, 10, 20, 30 years since Project Chariot resulted in firing of Dr. Pruitt, Virik, and others. When are they going to stand up and ask university to review the whole case? I could not do much more until 1993, when I became chairman of honorary degree committee. It was not easy, but I was able to get majority of one vote. My committee approved officially that Dr. Pruitt and all others who participated in Project Chariot deserve honorary doctorates for their exceptional scientific work on Project Chariot. As soon as this was out, President Komisar picked up the phone and told me, "So, Rudy, I have a latest news from you. You are going to organize a great party for people who participated in Project Chariot. I tell you one thing, as long as Dr. Wood is in the community, forget it. This is my last word. I expect you will follow my desire." Usually, you would follow desire of the president. I'm a Czech rebel. I decided to call Juno. My former students, who were senators, I asked them to do something, and they did. They passed a resolution in name of people of Alaska who are in favor of recognizing all these distinguished scientists for their work on Project Chariot. When this came to the university, nobody dared to challenge. So I am glad I did it, and I could not do otherwise.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm sharing part of a discussion I had with the late Rudy Krejci, who taught languages and philosophy at UAF. There is a celebration of Rudy's life planned for Sunday afternoon. When we return, Rudy's son, Paul, discusses his father's personality. You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This is a special Northern Soundings looking at the life and legacy of the late UAF professor Rudy Krejci. Rudy passed away last December. Rudy had an uncanny ability to be at significant moments and places in history, and B, meet and become friends with some of the key thinkers of the 20th century. I asked his son, Paul, to reflect on his father's personality.
He was a great storyteller, you know, and he was very animated. And he would, I think through that way, he was able to develop this great sort of teaching technique, you know, I think which really was able to connect then with students. Yeah, so I always recall, I sometimes took a few classes to sit and see what he was like. And, you know, he was very animated. That's the kind of one of the earliest impressions I have of him growing up. I was looking up at him. And even though my father wasn't very tall, he appeared tall because he was very thin. And he had this red hair. And I always thought of him as this very sociable, very cheerful sort of rooster. who was always kind of speaking, you know, gestulations and with this thick Czech accent, which made it perhaps even more interesting to listen to. And he developed this performance, this way of performing that involved, you know, body motion as well as articulation, intonation. And he developed those, I think, in a way that really impressed upon, you know, the listener.
I think that's one of the gifts he had as a teachers is that passion. Mm. And I think if you're going to inspire your pupils that this is worth studying, that this is an exciting venture, demonstrating that personally is a big boost to that.
Yeah, and it was his own experience, experiential knowledge, telling these stories. And he had a way, too, of telling other people's stories, but in a way kind of in the third person. But particularly in this case is where he experienced, you know, these often traumatic events. He always tells about explaining it, you digest it using your own juices. And through that sort of experience, that's what it really, when it comes alive, and that's how you can impart that onto another person who will, I think, like I said, be mesmerized by it, and it will stick in their head and carry it on maybe to another person, you know, as well.
Talk about an experience where ideas really do matter, mm-hmm. whether a national socialism with Nazis. These ideas are life and death situations that he experienced. So the power of ideas isn't something to monkey around with. He really conveyed that sort of mm-hmm. sense of importance.
He did, yes. I mean, he experienced the loss of a close friend at the end of World War II. He was 16 years old. I remember when I was 16 years old, you know, I was concerned with playing basketball. You know, that was as close as I got to being in a battle. And he was experiencing the retreat of German SS soldiers, and he was trying to steal a vehicle from them, and some Germans noticed it and shot at him, you know, with machine guns, and ended up killing his close friend who was right next to him. He remembers the blood of his friend being all over him and thinking it was his own, that he had been shot, but he was taken for dead. And fortunately, you know, that's what the Germans thought, and they left, you know, and he made his way then across a field then where his father was observing this from a distance. And his father explains it being very angry at him because of what could have happened. They could have rounded up everyone in the village as retaliation. I think at times my father didn't always think about some of the repercussions of his
actions. Well, when you're 16.
When you're 16, you don't think about it. Yeah.
But
his father,
he had siblings?
He had a sister, a younger sister, who was about 7 years younger than he. And she was athletic. She was a ballet dancer and a gymnast, and apparently was very talented. Unfortunately, in 1947, she died of some of the diseases brought upon by after the war, mass burials. And there was a lot of this airborne sort of disease that had she contracted and developed encephalitis and died. I think she was maybe 12 years old.
Wow. That must have been hard on your...
That was very hard, I think. He didn't really like to talk about
sure.
it so much. But that, think about it, that's 47, and then 48, the government collapses, and 49, he joins a student protest group, and eventually then in May 1st, that's the turning point in his life where he had to go underground, and his whole life changed then.
It strikes me that your dad became, because of his outgoing nature, when he pursues his philosophy degree, he really does seem to meet historically important figures and be at historically important places mm-hmm. and times.
I don't know what it is. It's uncanny, an ability of his to be able to always be there. And he tells me about, you know, these people that, the famous people that he interacted with. And for example, one of them is Erisman. Erisman, you familiar? He was the guy who did the vision sort of experiments where you have to wear the goggles and you turn upside down and ride a bicycle, you know,
yes.
and that you can train the brain, you know, to live just like you had been, you know, before. And so my father actually participated in those sort of experiments, you know.
No,
because Erisman, he was a professor at the University of Innsbruck in the mid-50s. So my father told me he rode the bicycle himself and wore the goggles. And so just things like that, he'd always make these encounters, these unplanned sort of encounters that really became revolutionary, I think, in many ways, you know, historically. In the sciences and in the arts. You think about, I mean, Europe's not such a large place, I guess, too, you know, and they have these centers, you know, learning, and people can gravitate towards. And so you can see how that would increase the odds of just interacting with others. And my father had this, he was gregarious, right? He was willing to just talk to someone, no matter who it was. And so I can understand, you know, why those sort of opportunities just open themselves up, you know, mm-hmm. if you just make the effort to make contact with someone.
Well, and then when he gets to the United States, he contradicts somebody and it leads to a job at Bechtel. And I think the chutzpah, he doesn't really know this person. And the fact that he exhibited that kind of level of confidence and expertise.
Yes, yeah. And I also wonder, too, just being 5 years clammed up in this household, he wanted to breathe. He wanted to escape and he wanted to enjoy his freedom and... He took advantage of that. He didn't like to be cooped up, I remember. He always wanted to be doing something, I think that's what helped, you know, contribute, you know, to his relative longevity, you know, living to be almost 90 years old and being in quite good health for much of it.
And you say as a young man, he was athletically quite active.
He was.
He was approached to be a professional soccer mm-hmm. player.
Yeah, and even hockey, he did hockey and soccer particularly, he was very good at. And he played like semi-professionally hockey. And then in soccer, he was given the opportunity to play at Barcelona team back in the 50s when he had escaped. By then, he said, because he had lost so much weight, you know, that his health had deteriorated so much that he didn't feel like he could do that. And so he committed to just cultivating his mind. Yeah, and he played tennis as well. That was another sport. So he played against this Czech tennis player who won Wimbledon back in the 50s. But my father played against him back when he was a teenager, right after World War II. He actually, he lost to him, I remember, you know, to this great tennis player. But then he got his comeuppance, and then he played him again back in the 90s, you know, like many decades later. He was introduced to him again in London and played another match. So they were in their 60s and 70s. And he just had these great stories, and I always just wanted to learn more. And towards the last couple of years, I began to really study more of these people that he had interacted with. And I would look him up on the internet, and lo and behold, yeah, he was pretty accurate, you know, about where these people were at a given time. And sure, he did meet them. And he just, again, had this very remarkable memory. He would be able to both give a sense of the really high-minded, abstract sort of ideas, but then be able to explain it, I guess, in a very simple way. If I ever were to write a book, it'd probably be going down that sort of avenue where it'd just be people that he met in his life. And they have a chapter devoted to each one of these individuals. I mean, I think that's one of the most remarkable things I remember about him telling his life story.
We've talked about his fearlessness, his gregariousness, his ability and forthrightness to speak his mind. This really had ramifications when Project Chariot came at the university, and he really was a champion to the two scientists, Viereck and Pruitt, that lost their jobs over it, and was instrumental in rehabilitation at the university by having their honorary degrees bestowed on them. That took courage. So mm-hmm. that's really a remarkable aspect.
It is, especially in the early years, you know, when he sure. didn't have tenure and he was just pretty new and he was expendable. I mean, he always stuck with it. It wasn't his nature to be silent. Fortunately for him, this is kind of an interesting thing I've thought about lately, is that he was also politically savvy. Talk about this particular time then in the 1990s, and he's working to rehabilitate Dr. Pruitt and Viereck. Who does he go to? He goes to politicians. These are people who had actually been his students. And some of these started just with the courses he was teaching in German and Russian. Some of these people met him already early then in the 60s, and then taking these philosophy classes. He had these connections that he established and developed, you know, quite a good rapport with a good number of them. And they say he taught thousands and thousands of students, and he, lo and behold, some of them are going to be helpful in the future. And I think it worked out, of course, very well for him. And of course, I think just
for Pruitt and Viereck.
And so in that regard, I was just thinking about, he was savvy in that way. But I think it was just his nature just to connect with others. And even if it meant abrasively, you know, and still he tried to have some type of dialogue, it could be a debate sort of style, about ideas. Other ways, too, I think he thought it was interesting. Things could always be otherwise. There is no certainty. The best way to destroy someone's argument, which they think is based on truth with a capital T, is to ask them, how do you know? How do you know this question? That's something I kind of learned as a child and a teenager, that always be skeptical, have a healthy degree of skepticism, and always try to figure out, where is this information coming from that someone supposedly has, if it's based on the truth with a capital T. Other great lines he had: out of mind, out of sight, you know, switching the two around. And I say, what? No, it's supposed to be out of sight, out of mind. He says, no, that blew my mind again, you know.
I remember the story. He said some religiously motivated students said, in the beginning is the word. And he goes, no, first the thought.
The thought behind it, yes. Yeah, the idea behind it, very Platonic.
Thinking of things, how they could be different. He was deeply concerned the way academy was going. Mm-hmm. And he would get on a pulpit, either at the local paper or elsewhere, and talk about his concern.
Of course, he was deeply concerned about that. Of course, with his idea of old sort of structures of the university built on the quadrivium and the trivium, those sort of being lost. Of course, this idea of a liberal arts education and how that's becoming less value today. And at the university, it seems to operate more like a business, and you have to kind of show the education that you receive is what can you do with this? How does this work? How does this work in society? But how does it work really in an economic standpoint, particularly? And of course, you have grave concerns about that. It comes to something, again, with philosophy. And so, he was hearing these same sort of ideas, that he had been introduced to when he came to the United States and talking with President Patty, and that was something that makes sense. And those ideas kept on coming back and back, and it seems to be more and more the case, especially now. And he fought against that sort of idea.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. This program is focused on the life and legacy of Dr. Rudy Krejci. When we return from this short break, some closing remarks about Rudy as a family man. Soundings. I'm saluting Dr. Rudy Krejci, who taught and served at the University of Alaska Fairbanks for decades. Rudy passed away last December. There's a celebration of his life planned for this Sunday afternoon from 2 to 7 at the Dog Mushers Hall in Fairbanks. I close the program with Dr. Paul Krejci, Rudy's son. I asked Paul how and when his parents met.
They met really pretty much soon after my father arrived in Innsbruck. My father says, that he actually saw my mom before she had seen him and noticed that, she's a very attractive lady. So my father had noticed her. What's interesting is that he actually then met my mom's sister first. It was an accidental encounter on a ski slope where she had fallen and my father, went to pick her up. And he asked her out on a date. My mom's sister didn't care for it. He said he was too intellectual for him. Yeah, all he does is talk about books and ideas. And so says, maybe, talking to my mom, so maybe you'd be interested, because my mom, she liked to read. And so they went on a date and there was a spark, I guess. And we're together for a good number of years and then got married. And my oldest sister, Sonia, was born in Innsbruck. And my father had already left the United States, to try to find some position, And so this is kind of looking back now, it's kind of interesting. Yeah, they hadn't actually seen each other for about a year and he hadn't actually seen his daughter that long. And then my mom and eldest sister, Sonia, traveled then across, over the bowl and arrived in Anchorage early 1961. This is a few months then after my dad had secured a position at university and father met them in Anchorage and brought him up to Fairbanks. And it was difficult for my mom. She had left beautiful Innsbruck in Tyrol, real picturesque scene, and this family that she missed considerably. There's this beautiful to lead. It's called Innsbruck, ich muss dich lassen. Innsbruck, I must leave you. It's a famous work by Isaac, a Renaissance composer. And she remembers singing this song then with her family before departing. And I think about, from her perspective, just going to this place up north called Alaska, she had kind of heard about, but
It must have been like the end of the it was end Mars. Of the,
was like that. It's like that, and having almost a 1-year-old with her arriving then in Anchorage, and then coming up the Fairbanks, which seemed, Anchorage seemed okay. It seemed larger, and it was a little, of course, more southerly, and climate was a little bit more appealing to her. But then arriving in Fairbanks, it was a hell hole, I think, at first when she arrived. But it took many years, and she gradually began to love the place. And it's what she appreciated when she was at the university. It was meeting people from all around the world, the wives often of professors who were from Pakistan, from India. And one thing that she told me was so fascinating when she was living in the facilities on campus. She knew about Indian and Pakistan had their problems, political, but then she realized that these two individuals were able to interact with each other and become very close friends. And she really remarked this ability of the university to be able to do that, to draw people from all around the world and forge these friendships that otherwise you may not have to bring about. And so, yeah, after a few more siblings, I'm the youngest in the family, father and then my mother then worked on building the house, which is still
now, when
around.
Was that built?
It was built in 1965.
And he designed it?
He designed it. It's a kind of a Tyrolean-style house.
You think he built it for her?
So? I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, to appease her. To remind her of Innsbruck. And, of course, for himself as well, because we had met. And Innsbruck provided him with a lot. He was able to get, of course, a PhD out of it. And yeah, and that house is still standing. It's built in 65, so it's over 50 years old.
Wow.
I recall that there were some great scientific figures, mathematicians who would come visit. They're stereotypical type of professors who just, they don't have a family perhaps, and they just are committed to their work. And but they couldn't understand why my father couldn't do like certain things, like publishers, but they didn't realize, you know, that he raised a family and he built a home. So many other aspects of his life that weren't just teaching philosophy. He was living the philosophy, I think, as well. And that was expressed in so many ways outside of the university. And he probably wouldn't have thought of it as strange, you know, that it was just something that he had lived and he breathed every day.
Well, I can't thank you enough, Paul Krejci, mm-hmm. for talking with me today about your dad.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's it for Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Links to Rudy's Wikipedia page and a wonderful short documentary on him by author Dan O'Neill are on the Northern Soundings page. Music on the show today was performed by Dr. Paul Krejci for that documentary. My thanks to Paul for his permission to use it. Until next time, thanks for listening.